I do have a soda. I'm going to get some water.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. Thanks for your patience as we gather a group here. We're going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 2766. We have lots to testify. And Troy, if you could give us a summary, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2766 increases existing tax on aircraft fuel sold, used, or distributed by dealer from 9 cents per gallon to 11 cents per gallon, specifies revenue from increase to be used for deferred maintenance of state-owned airports that do not receive federal funding and to ongoing operations of the Oregon Department of Aviation, effective 91 days after adjournment of the 2013 session.
Thank you. We have a long list of folks to testify. We'll start with Senator Johnson, and I think there are a couple people you want to bring with you.
Chris Marks, please.
Great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of representing Senate District 16. Also, in the interest of full disclosure, I want to say that back about a million years ago, I ran this agency. And so I have a pretty deep knowledge of how the Department of Aviation functions and its system, and I put heavy emphasis on system. The Department of Aviation maintains responsibility to develop aviation as an integral part of Oregon's transportation network. They draft and implement procedures and programs to ensure safety in the aviation industry, and they encourage the economic growth that's often associated with the aviation industry, including supporting education and safety issues related to aviation, and work to increase both general and commercial aviation traffic and assets within the state of Oregon. Our Department of Aviation was formed in 1921. That predates the federal government by 5 years. We predate the FAA. And it proved that Oregon was a national leader in the development and regulation of the aviation industry, having authorities to regulate pilots and aircraft in addition to their federal regulation. Today, colleagues, we passed in the Senate the Columbia River crossing. And in his carrying speech, Bruce Starr talked a lot about transportation as a system, and I think the chair may have been on the floor when this was going on, and the obligation for the legislature to respond when pieces of a system are facing crisis. As the CRC was described, I would submit to you that our system of airports is in crisis. We connect freight, passengers, public safety. We are involved in natural resource management, and you will hear in the testimony as it moves forward the blow that Oregon got today with the notification that we're going to lose 5 federally funded towers. I would submit to you that that is going to put aviation in Oregon at great risk. 4 of these airports are commercial service airports, including North Bend, Klamath Falls, periodically Salem, and Pendleton. Yes. Also, the general aviation airport affected is Troutdale, with 150,000 operations a year, right in the pathway of PDX, which I think makes that a particularly sensitive airport to no longer have the benefit of professional air traffic controllers. My purpose in coming here today is to ask for your strong consideration of this bill. Amendments may be offered to it. I want to share with you the 100,000-foot view that aviation is a system in Oregon. It is important to our economic development. And to remind you all that a mile of pavement will take you across town. A mile of runway will take you across the world. I hope you think about that as you deliberate on this bill today. Thank you. I will turn it over to my colleagues and ask to be excused. Unless there are questions, I have to go testify on another bill.
Thank you, Senator. Before she leaves, any quick questions for her? I don't see any. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you. My name is Chris Korich. I'm the Vice Chair of the State Aviation Board. I live at 6595 Southwest Alden, Portland. I'm here you to pass what will become, I hope, the amended version of 2766, which would include the 2 cent tax on jet fuel. So,
and let me just interrupt for the benefit of the committee and note that the amendments, I think, of which you speak, the dash ones, are in OLIS. So as you go ahead, colleagues, you can feel free to to look at those amendments, as I'm sure you will describe them.
Thank you. And I think the benefit of this amendment is you know what you're going to get. 40% of the revenue from this amendment would be used to match FAA grants. The Federal Aviation Administration in the last 4 years has spent $259 million into the state, which was matched by local sponsors. A large airport such as Portland International came up with a 20% match. Small airports had to come up with 5%. They've now changed that 5% match of project cost to 10%. If this bill were to pass, the Department of Aeronautics would help by filling in 5% of that 10%. So essentially, it would help these projects occur when they might not otherwise do so. The bill proposes to spend 22% of the revenue for a program called FAM grants, which is aid to municipalities. Essentially, it would offer up to $25,000 to municipalities to work on projects that are not eligible for FAA funds or for which the FAA does not fund as a priority. And so this is hugely important to help the projects move forward in the state. 3% of the funds would be used for the Department of Aeronautics to meet its obligation for search and rescue. With the budget difficulties that we've had, we haven't been able to make that commitment paid. It's to go out and look for overdue or lost pilots. And finally, the state of Oregon, speaking to Betsy's comment, operates a system of 28 airports that either they own or they manage for other agencies. So 35% of the revenue for this would help them operate those airports, and some of them are in a distressed state of maintenance, and so these funds are important. So to summarize, 62% of the funds would go to municipalities either in matching FAA dollars or in FAM grants to help maintain and develop the aviation system. 2% would go to search and rescue, and the remaining 35% to help the state run the airports that it has. Now, you may say, well, what's the funding crisis? What's going on here? In the last 13 years, the airlines have bought larger and more fuel-efficient aircraft, and that's been good for all of us. It keeps ticket prices down. It's good for the environment when they burn less fuel. But it's bad for a department that relies upon jet fuel as its major source of revenue, and this is not uncommon. Probably most of the aviation departments, state aviation departments in the country, use this method to fund all or part of their operations. We are one of the lowest. So even though passenger levels are up, takeoffs and landings and jet fuel sales are down, and that has just been putting the squeeze on this department and something we need to turn around. Finally, what's the benefit to the passengers at PDX who will likely end up paying an extra 42 cents per ticket on average if this goes through? Well, there'll be jobs in Oregon that come with a strong economy that airports support. There's probably a 50 to 60% chance that the pilot in front of the plane is not going to be military trained, but they're going to learn to fly at an airport like one of the 97 we have in this state. There's a good chance that their forests will be protected from fires because the airports support, even the very small ones, firefighting throughout the state. And finally, if you have a health issue, you're probably going to be close enough to one of the airports in the state that you can be taken to medical treatment. So it's going to be hugely important that we maintain this system of airports, and I urge your consideration of the amendment when it comes before you. As Betsy said, we have a great history of support and a great aviation system. We'd hate to see it decline. Thank you very much.
Mr. Gorsh, other questions?
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the where's the primary source of the funds? Is it from the large Portland? Is that where most of this money is coming from?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Reed, yes. Portland International, the jets, the commercial airliners there are, I'm guessing, 90, 95%. When I came up with that number of 42 cents per ticket, I took the average of all revenue earned from jet fuel and divided that by the number of passengers. And so it does come from the large air carriers.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The total amount you anticipate will be raised?
Chairman Reed, Representative, last year, 2012, the jet fuel tax raised about $1.5 million statewide. So if we take that from 1 to 3 cents, we'd be about $4.5 million for a year and about $9 million per biennium, assuming the same amount of fuel is sold.
I'm sorry. Follow up.
Yes, please.
Can you go through that again?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry.
Tell us what it is today, and then if you would, what it would be if this passed.
$1.5 million in calendar year 2012. That was the revenue from jet fuel statewide, and times three, that would be $4.5 million per year statewide, all sources.
Please. And the and that $4.5 million per year, or roughly $9 million per biennium, would then be allocated in the percentages you just mentioned, the 60%, the 62% to municipalities and so forth. But how is that allocated? Is it someone just gets a check, or they have to ask for it, or what actually happens?
Chairman Reed, Representative, there is an existing process for the FAM grants, which hasn't been funded in many years. There is an application process, and there would be an application process in going forward in the future as well.
Thank you. And the need, what is there a measure of the need for this? Is there some number that hasn't been fulfilled, or in other words, why $9 million? Why not $50 million? What is it that's determining the 2 cent increase?
Chairman Reed and Representative, I think that is a question that the staff would be best qualified to answer. There is a capital improvement list that exists today, and we have, I know they have looked at the amount of money that the FAA brings into the state, and there was some discussion about that. The state is working to develop a statewide capital improvement program, and I don't have a solid answer for you right now, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Perhaps you can help us follow up on that a bit later. Representative Parrish?
So when planes go into these small strips, do they pay landing fees like they do, like the big airliners do at Portland?
Chairman?
On top of the gas?
No, they don't. Typically, they do not. It's unusual at a small airport for general aviation to pay a landing fee.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Betts?
Thank you. So can the argument, or has the argument been made, that somehow these large planes that are paying most of this fuel need some of those smaller airstrips? I know as I'm flying from Boise to Portland and back, which I do too many times, I'm often wondering when one of the engines fails where they're going to put it down out there. What does happen? Any of these little airports, would they ever be able to manage a big jet, or more likely one of these Alaskan airline prop things that we're always on?
Chairman, a Dash 8 turboprop could land in 3,000 feet, and there are a lot of runways in eastern Oregon and between Boise and Portland that are 3,000 feet long, so that's hugely important. Ontario has got a very nice runway straight in line with that traffic. Pendleton, I mean, there's just John Day has got a 5,000-foot runway, so there are plenty of places they could land. Even a large commercial airliner, given a choice of landing in the sticks versus landing on a runway that might be too short, is going to pick the runway if they can find it, and if they declare an emergency, the FAA has the ability to direct them to the closest strip of runway and maybe give them a choice. Well, if you can make it to this one, it's longer.
Go ahead. And this doesn't happen too frequently. I haven't heard of any of those putting down out in those kind of places. Yeah, the last time I heard of one was when something crashed in Portland years ago. This is the last time I heard of a big airliner coming down unexpectedly. So, although it's a good argument, how frequently would it be necessary?
Chairman, I guess the example I would give is the wildlife strike in New York, where they landed in the Hudson River. There are wildlife issues throughout the Northwest. I know we spent a lot of time working at Portland International Airport to manage the wildlife. So could that have happened, and where would it have happened relative to the airport? It's hard to say. But the airlines are incredibly reliable, and I'm certainly happy to get on any airliner that pulls up to the gate, because I know they're well-maintained and very proficient.
Thank you.
Representative Parrish.
Thanks. So assuming this passes, how much money do you need to do all the capital improvement work that is out there? How long will this tax, I mean, how many years of this tax would that actually take? And then capital maintenance is kind of upgraded and done, money pools there. What happens to the money after that?
Chairman Reed, Representative Parrish, the quantity of the amount of money that we're looking at conducting here, I don't believe is going to accumulate in a large fund, given that all the pavements we have in this state eventually deteriorated. Some of the airports have multiple runways. You repair them one at a time. I don't think we're at great risk, but we can try and get that information back to you about the unmet need right now and try and answer your question that both of you have had. I think I'd rather do that.
One of the other benefits of asking these questions now is that the people who are signed up to testify following Mr. Korch are, I'm sure, taking notes and anticipating some of our questions. They may also have some answers. Unless there are other questions for you. Thank you very much. Next up, Mary Rosenblum and David Martin, please. And since we have an extra chair here, Bob Hall, I missed you on the list too. Sorry about that.
Representative Reed and committee members, I am Mary Rosenblum. I am president-elect of Oregon Pilots Association and representing Oregon Pilots Association here today. We are very concerned about the passage of this bill with the addition of the Dash 1 amendment that adds 2-cent jet fuel to this. This is on the surface, this is a tax issue, but in reality, this is a user fee. Nobody who does not benefit, either directly or indirectly, from aviation is going to pay a penny toward this. And we're talking about systems and our aviation system. We need to talk about our system of general aviation. I don't think people are aware of the economic and job impact of general aviation on this state. In the last year, general aviation pumped more than $2 billion into the Oregon economy and another $171 million in terms of visitor purchases, people at airports and local airports, not PDX, who bought restaurant meals, resort time, services, shops, and so on. These are jobs, and this is an economic income to the state that is going away. Our general aviation system is decaying. Even if you raise the tax on aviation gasoline by 10 cents a gallon, we cannot fund the required maintenance. Where what is being hit are the small municipalities, the Burns, the Cresswells, the Florence. The FAA mandates a minimum amount of safety maintenance that's required for safe landings, whether it's a 737 in trouble or a 152. And the cities have to, or the counties that own these airports, are required to pay a share. This, as you heard, has gone up from 5% to 10%. For a small city like Burns, for example, they have, I think, about, they may have 120,000 coming up in a couple of years. They have to pay that. That's their share of the larger bill. And it was 51,000 before. And this is coming out of their general funds. And in parts of the country, parts of the state, where agriculture and fishing and so on is being hit hard by the economy, they're struggling to make their ends meet, and they have no options. That's why that this larger amount of money generated by the 2-cent jet fuel is going to help these cities keep their airports healthy, keep their deferred maintenance managed, so that they can make the economic improvements. We have Google and Facebook right now, who are out in Prineville. They're out there because it is less expensive to be there than Silicon Valley. We're being looked at by Silicon Valley companies. But these companies require access to PDX. They require access to the Portland area. This is a benefit for the PDX airlines. They have to be able to get back and forth, and they're not going to drive if they can't use their jet traffic to commute between Prineville or John Day or the Dalles or wherever they locate. They won't be there. They'll go to Washington or Idaho, where they can find airports. So we need to keep our airports good. We have the Dalles, which has a 5,000-foot runway. The pavement is graded as poor. You are not going to land a biz jet on that pavement. The Dalles, it does not have the money right now to pay their share of resurfacing that runway. They're going to be in trouble perhaps when they do, and that's something that this grant will allow us to assist in. As Chris alluded to, there is benefit to the aviation industry. Boeing is predicting the need for 460,000 new pilots. FAA requires mandatory retirement, and we have a large percentage of the FAA pilots flying today commercially who will be forced to retire. It used to be that 70% of these slots were filled by military. That's no longer the case. It's some sources are saying that there's going to be virtually no military pilots, but under 50% certainly. And these pilots are going to come from somewhere. You don't do flight training at PDX. You do flight training at Molino and Aurora and Prineville and Burns. And if we don't have these small airports, we are going to have a much smaller pool of pilots who are qualified to fly these airlines. I do not personally want to be in an airliner that runs into trouble with a pilot who learned how to fly in a simulator. We've had a couple of very bad accidents. There was one in D.C. where a plane crashed coming down on the runway in ice, where it was the pilot's inexperience that caused that crash. This is going to happen. This is more likely to happen if pilots have no stick and rudder time. You need small airports in order to gain stick and rudder time. So this is not a case where we're asking the airlines to simply pick up the tab for something that does not affect them. Again, you have the huge benefit to small towns and municipalities, emergency services, firefighting, agricultural ops. A lot of the reason our agricultural products are as cheap as they are is because you've got spray planes out there. And if you have to go in with trucks and hand labor, the price for that broccoli is going to go up significantly. We've had cities such as Pacific City and Crescent Lake where as soon as they heard that there was a possibility that the airport would close, the people in the towns rallied. They do not want their airports closed. Those airports have huge value to them. A lot of it is simply the matter of cash. We don't have enough cash in our aviation system because we don't have the taxes. And if you look at the price of the tax on jet fuel, even if we add 2 cents to our jet fuel tax today, we will still have the lowest tax on jet fuel in the western U.S. Nobody is going to go anywhere else to fuel up, even at 3 cents a gallon. Nobody will beat us.
I'll break in there to take a lesson from the chair of the Revenue Committee. There he has made a good practice of pointing to things in OLAS as people testifying have made use of them, and Ms. Rosenblum has a map in OLAS of our neighboring states and what their fuel taxes are, so you might look at that as well.
Right, yes, and if, for example, California has a 2 cents a gallon tax plus a 7.25% sales tax, which equates to an additional 23 cents a gallon. Washington State is 11 cents a gallon for all aviation fuel plus their sales tax. Montana is 4 cents a gallon for all aviation fuel. Wyoming is 5 cents a gallon. So these are just examples. I could go on. The list continues. You do have the map. But we are not going to see our jets fueling up somewhere else because we have raised our tax on jet fuel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's hear from you, gentlemen, and then we'll see if there are questions for the panel.
Chairman Reed, members of the committee, my name is David Martin. I'm also on the board of the Oregon Pilot Association, and Ms. Rosenblum has outlined for you the major details. I'd just like to point out that the Oregon Department of Aviation is, in fact, grossly underfunded for the 28 airports that it is required to maintain, and we know that without an additional supply of cash, that many of these small airports are going to be closed. And we know that some of them are vital. In fact, all of them are vital from the standpoints that have been mentioned, but some are also vital to their local communities, as has been mentioned. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Sir, Mr. Hall.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Bob Hall. I reside at 17030 Southeast Kelly, Portland, Oregon. I'm representing the Troutdale chapter of the Oregon Pilots Association here today. I am a pilot. I have an airplane out at Troutdale, just a little tiny one, but it's still an airplane. Our membership feels very strongly that we have got to do something to maintain the safety of our airports. I'd like to bring kind of talking about how these outlining small airports actually provide us, you know, a safety factor. I'm what's called the Aero Volunteer for the Nehalem Bay State Airport. The Oregon Pilots Association, a bunch of us pilots, have adopted outlining airports that aren't manned all the time to keep the department abreast of what condition the runways are in. If I'm willing to land on it in my airplane, most other people will too. Nehalem Bay is, if you're unaware of it, it's actually between Nehalem and Manzanita on the Nehalem Bay State Park property. Highway 101 is oftentimes in the winter closed north of Tillamook after a large halt and a heavy rainstorm. It's closed south of Seaside with a heavy rainstorm. Highway 53, you're going to break your tail light as you come around some of these corners, so they're so tight, and there's oftentimes slides there. Highway 26, windstorms, trees are down. In other words, you've got a number of communities, Manzanita and Nehalem, on down the coast, clear down to Garibaldi and Bay City, that there is could be no access for medical emergencies in that area. Nehalem Bay State Airport is at just a 2,400 foot hard surface runway. The Coast Guard uses it for their helicopters sometimes, and Mercy Flight uses it. In fact, there was some discussion on park planning here 10 years ago or so, where there was a discussion about whether we really needed to maintain or have Nehalem Bay Airport. The Coast Guard came back in and said, yes, we do, for the safety reasons. Mercy Flight said, yes, we do, for the safety reasons. Nobody's manned there. There's about something in excess of 1,000, 1,500 operations per year coming in out of that little airport. So this isn't just, a little strip out in the, that nobody uses. Also, talking a little bit about the Port of Portland and PDX, which we've talked about quite a bit with the big airlines. The Port of Portland also owns two other airports, Hillsboro, which is a general aviation airport, which is a lot of operations and a lot of commercial jet traffic out of there. Now, when I say commercial, I'm not talking airlines. I'm talking about business jets. Troutdale, that's just where I fly out of all the time. We no longer have any jets stationed there, but we did recently, until recently. And it's not unusual to see a small biz jet, Cessna Mustang, something like that, up on the ramp, at the Gorge Winds Aviation. But Mary was talking about the issue of student pilots. Troutdale is scheduled to have 150,000 operations this year. I think that figure has already come up. The vast majority of those operations are student pilots. These are the ladies and gentlemen. They're going to be flying the 757s, the 787s, and the airliners of the future. This is where they're getting the training. These are low-time pilots, short on experience, and they need to have these good airports to train at. Like I say, our group is definitely in favor of House Bill 2677. We've used it as a user fee. If the Dash 1 amendments are not adopted, in other words, bringing parity, some not even close to parity between jet and avgas, then I'm not sure, I don't think our pilots would still be behind the bill. And this is being a little bit getting to Representative Bent's comment about airliners landing in small airports. I don't know, probably nobody here is old enough but me to remember when a DC-8 landed at the Troutdale Airport.
Mm-hmm. I remember that story.
That's 5,000-foot runway. It wasn't an emergency situation. It was just a sleepy pilot coming back from Honolulu. But the point being is, here's a small airliner that could land on a small general aviation field. A lot of the fields over in Eastern Oregon, Redmond, LeGrand, to name just a couple, they're ex-military fields. So they've got definitely have the capacity to handle the big boys if the pavement is maintained. I want to thank you for your time, and if I could answer any questions, I'll be glad to.
Thank you, Michelle. Representative Gorsuch.
I have a question. I live 2 miles from Troutdale, so I see the traffic all the time, plus then the bigger traffic. My brother-in-law has been a non-commercial pilot in the past, and he was telling me that there are, even if the tower is unfortunately down, that you can still do landings there, that they have an automated capability for that. Is that true?
Yeah, Chair Reed, Representative Gorsuch. Yeah, absolutely. There's an awful lot of non-towered airports. And if you look at your sectional, which is the charts that we fly by, it'll give a communications frequency on there. So as you're coming into, say, Nehalem Bay or to a non-towered airport, you're about 5 miles out. You tell them over the air, you know, let's say, Nehalem Bay State Airport, this is Cessna so-and-so, 5 East, and I'll tell them the way I'm intending to land. So anybody that's flying into there should be monitoring that frequency, and they would hear what I'm planning on doing, and they will come back on and say, yes, this is XYZ, and here's where I'm at, and we'll coordinate amongst ourselves.
Okay. Follow up. The other thing that I've noticed is that you were talking about pilots being trained there. Mm-hmm. There seems to be a whole bunch of folks from what I would guess is Japan that are staying in the apartments on 257th, and then they walk over to the field and apparently take their training. Is that correct?
Yeah, Chair Reed, Representative Gorsuch. Yes, that's absolutely correct. It's not Japan, they're Chinese.
Oh, okay.
And they're being trained at Hillsborough Aviation, and there is a bunch of them.
Oh,
I
yeah.
I don't know what the number is.
You see almost a parade of people walking back and forth all the time.
And wear these red jackets.
Yeah, exactly.
There's also another FBO there, Gorge Winds Aviation. They've got, last time I talked to Marv, a friend of mine that owns it, he's had something in excess of 20 flight instructors there.
Wow.
A fleet of about 7 or 8 airplanes. I might have exaggerated a little bit on that number. I'd have to back up and you don't count them. But it's a pretty good fleet, and there's an awful lot of aircraft flying out of Gorge Winds. Hillsborough Aviation with their Chinese students is significantly greater volume. But still, they all contribute to this 150,000 operations we're expecting this year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions, Representative Parrish?
Thanks. So the map that you provided, this northwestern mountain regions map, and it kind of breaks down everybody's, all the states in the region, all of their fuel, is this specifically how they all fund their maintenance, or is there another mechanism in these other states that they use, bonding or...
Now, this is generally speaking, departments of aviation are generally funded from jet and aviation fuel taxes. And we are actually one of the few, if not the only state, that does not already assist our municipally owned airports, does not assist the municipalities with their grant match. There are many states that pick up the entire FAA grant match that are much better funded. For example, the state of Virginia, who has more money than they know what to do with. And so it is the standard method of funding aviation departments.
Thank you.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hall, I think you mentioned just briefly, you said without the Dash Ones, your pilot association would not support the bill. Can you talk about that, please?
Chair Reed, Representative Cameron. Yes, I'd be glad to talk about it. Right now, we are paying 9 cents a gallon for our avgas, jet traffic. And we're not talking just airliners now. There's an awful lot of turbine-powered aircraft flying in and out of, you know, these airports from, you know, Troutdale, whatever. And they are paying 1 cent a gallon. These are heavier airplanes, taking more runway. They put more stress on the way. It's just like the principle of the weight mile tax for vehicles. The heavier vehicles are going to pay more tax. Well, we're absolutely the reverse here, you know, as far as aviation is concerned. So if we don't, we're more than willing to go from 9 cents to 11 cents per gallon. I have not talked to one pilot that has any problem with that. 9 to 11 cents if jet fuel will go up the same 2 cents. So the difference between the two is still maintaining the same. But the amount of money that would be raised by just an avgas tax increase of 2 cents just wouldn't fill the bill. And our people would be just picking up more and more and more of the share when everybody's benefiting from it.
Yeah.
Well, maybe this panel can answer. What's the tax per passenger that's being paid at Portland International now?
What type?
Well, you can call it a user fee. I'll call it a tax.
I think the I understand that it is a tax if you look at the ORS, as I understand that. But I think Mr. Courage said he said that in his testimony, and I don't want to misquote him.
Right.
If you don't mind.
We can follow up offline,
yeah.
I suspect.
Yeah.
I'll see it right away, so we'll follow up.
Thank you.
Are there other questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
And next up, John Dunlop. Dunlop, I'm not sure. And Roger Martin, please. Roger, you're up.
Hi. Hi there.
Would you like to get us started? Just start with your name. And
yeah, my name is John Dunlap. Live in Deschutes County. Private pilot, small single-engine Cessna airplane. I really can't add much to what has already been said. I just wanted to give my support that we need this fuel increase, tax increase on both avgas and on jet fuel to maintain our small municipal airports. I got a place in Pacific City, and any given Sunday or Saturday, if it's a beautiful day, I can count 15 to 20 airplanes flying into Pacific City on the Oregon coast, and they're all parking and they're going into town. And that would, you know, and that's one of the airports that might go away if we don't get some support. And that's going to be really hard on the small businesses in Pacific City if all of a sudden that airport's gone. So I'm just here to support the tax as a private pilot.
Thank you very much. Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, and for the last 30 years I've had the honor of representing Alaska Airlines. I say that because, unlike a lot of corporations, you won't find a better corporate citizen than Alaska Airlines. We are the main sponsor of the new sports team in Portland. Every time I talk to a legislator and mention that I represent Alaska, the usual response is my favorite airline. We've gone out of our way to try to maintain that. We give something over $250,000 in charity each year in the state of Oregon, not elsewhere, but in the state of Oregon. And last Sunday, there was an article that I would recommend, in fact, I will forward it to you, in the New York Times about Alaska Airlines being at the top of the heap of all the airlines. I'm proud of them, and I'm here today because Alaska Airlines also is the spokes company for the Air Transportation Association, which is the group of all the commercial airlines in the United States. You've heard comments about we have such a low tax in Oregon. I guess the question is, do airlines pay their share of costs in Oregon? And I need to give you just a little uptick on what goes on. We absolutely do. We pay some of the highest per passenger fees at the commercial airports we serve of any airport on the West Coast. Because, for one thing, PDX, a wonderful airport, I'm sure you share the same feeling I have every time you fly back from crowded Chicago or Atlanta. Boy, it's nice to be back here. But PDX is overbuilt. It was built to try to maintain Lufthansa and those other foreign airlines that we don't have anymore. We end up with a big airport. We work with the Port of Portland all the time trying to get the cost down. We pay lease fees and landing fees. The jet fuel tax you're talking about, which when I started off was a half a cent a gallon and it was raised to 1 cent a few years ago, goes exclusively to the Department of Aviation, who we have nothing to do with. The Department of Aviation, although it's a wonderful agency and it does all kinds of things, doesn't work with the commercial airlines at all. Now, the argument may be made that they can train pilots, and I don't want to get into whether we'd be without pilots if we didn't have aviation. But what you're talking about when you have this given to you about other states is one very common thing. What do we not have that every other state has? A sales tax. And Mr. Chairman, I have in my hot little hand here one of the sales tax bills that you're sponsoring. And I would suggest if you want to get the jet fuel, and it's a use tax, up to a higher level, pass that, because this is illustrative of all the other things that go untaxed in Oregon for general purposes. But we have developed over the years all the necessary ways of funding air transportation, the commercial part of it. And I don't want to argue with anybody. I'm sure that there is need. But to ask us, what you're asking here is we want the airlines to pay sales tax. We're not going to have a general sales tax. We're going to have a sales tax on jet fuel so we can perform this one function as needed as it is. And I would suggest to you, for one thing, that's exactly why Connect Oregon was invented. Most of you are familiar with it. It's been around for a number of sessions. Chair Reed has been one of the premier reasons it's been successful in getting it done. And it was invented to fund those non-highway transportation things that we can't fund out of the gas tax. And air has been part of that. And airports have received funding in the past, and it has been used. I believe that Ontario has used those fundings to match the federal grant to do upgrades there. Current conversation going on with Connect Oregon is we ought to carve out a section exclusively for private or for the airports in Oregon. That's really where the funding ought to come for this. If you pass this, you're talking for every penny of tax increase, you're talking to us, I'm talking to Alaska Airlines, $367,000 a year more that we're going to pay, and for that we're not going to get anything. Now, I said I don't want to argue with aviation, and I really don't, but I want to give you an illustration. Unwittingly, probably, aviation has been a competitor of ours. Let me tell you how. A few years ago, a good friend of mine happens to be the president of the company, started Seaport Airlines to compete directly with Alaska Airlines on flights from PDX to Seattle, and won for 3 years. Now, they weren't making enough there, so they turned to the Department of Aviation and received a grant to fly between Astoria and Portland, Newport and Portland. At one time, they were trying out of Salem and Portland. So aviation is actually, I don't think they thought of it this way, but they were supplying competition money against the commercial airlines to compete with us. Now, since that time, Seaport has figured out they can't compete, and they've dropped the flight to Seattle, but in the process, lessened our profit margin by a considerable amount of money. I hope we can have further conversation on this, but I would urge you to realize what you're talking about is a sales tax on jet fuel, and I don't see why we need to do that unless there's some correlation better than I've heard between commercial airlines and this tax increase.
Thank you, Mr. Martin, and thank you particularly for your big red ink on the bill that I'm part of.
As long as you brought it up, I want to tell you why.
Okay.
When I served in this body ancient years ago, Republicans sponsored a sales tax, and the Democratic leader in the House was a guy by the name of Jim Redden, who's a federal judge now.
And my constituents.
Every day he would get up and say, I am shocked and appalled that the Republicans are going to do this to the little people of Oregon and saddle this with them with this onerous tax. So Friday, I went to lunch with him, and I asked him to apologize by sending the same speech to you.
I'll look forward to receiving it. Thank you. Other questions? Well, I have two. I could start with, and I imagine there are others as well. So am I hearing you correctly that you're saying essentially that the map is an incomplete picture of what Alaska is paying?
It's an incomplete picture as far as Oregon is concerned, because
right.
We don't have to pay. Every airport is funded in different manners, but you can be assured the airport is paid for by the airlines, not by taxpayers, the larger ones. And I just saw this for the first time this afternoon, so
sure.
I'm going to try to get some more information and talk about what happens in other states. I've been told the sales tax in the state of Washington is 9.6%, and that's what we pay in the way of jet fuel in Washington.
Okay.
But I've been scrambling to try to get accurate figure for you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. One is I think the airports are paid for by the people who are buying the tickets.
Correct.
Not the airlines.
I'm sorry.
And I'm looking at the relating to clauses. Will that bill work in this?
Yes, very good. Sorry. A little slow.
Again.
Are you trying to be funny again?
Never.
He doesn't try. He
can't. So, one other question then, Mr. Martin. You mentioned during the course of your long association with Alaska that it's the tax moved from half cent to 1 cent at one point. Was that something you were supportive of then? And if so, what allowed you to be supportive? In other words, is there a time when it should increase, and how do we identify that?
Chair, members of the committee, that's a good question. I want to go back and check
the circumstances, but there was, in the mid-90s, there was a general increase in all fuel taxes across the board by the Oregon Department of Transportation. At that time, I believe aeronautics was part of the, was a division of the Department of Transportation at that time. I want to go back and find out. I don't think any company is ever willing to say, yeah, we'll pay a higher tax, but there are circumstances that come up, and it went up at that time.
That'd be interesting to know more about that history, if that's available. Thank you. Other questions, Representative Davis?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I'm trying to get a scope of sort of the industry as a whole. It seems to me that the testimony we've heard indicates that the big guys would essentially be paying this in large part because they're the big purchasers of fuel in the state of Oregon to fund the little guys. And with the airline industry, it's not like we're dealing with hedge funds here. I think I recently heard a statistic that over the life of commercial airlines, the industry in America has actually lost $40 billion, and we see that almost every year in bankruptcies for major airlines. And so preserving Northwest Airlines is a concern of mine. And I wonder if you can talk about the financial state of the industry in the Northwest right now.
You meant an airline based in the Northwest, not Northwest Airlines. Right?
Yes, just thank you, Chair. Thank you.
They don't exist anymore.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, I would like to be able to do that, except I think I need some more time to get that information. In the case of Alaska Airlines, and this article points it out, Alaska in the last 33 of the last 39 years has made a profit. That's mm-hmm. not true of some of the larger airlines, and you've read all about the mergers and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
We pride ourselves on trying to keep costs fair and the service good and still make a profit. And I think at least one of the airports in Oregon, this doesn't come from me, but somebody will give you this information, has already called to say, whatever you do, don't raise the jet fuel tax and endanger some of our flights. Airports in Oregon are fighting all the time to try to retain the flights they have. Now, I can't say that's a threat by us. We have Horizon Airlines in Alaska, and Portland is a hub. We're not about to move, but some of the other airlines are in and out of here, and a small increase in costs, and they're going to change their mind about where they're going to go.
Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If ever there was an airline that supported Bush pilots, I'm guessing it would be Alaska Airlines, and there's a lot that's been said earlier this afternoon about the good things that come from small airstrips, that is, training pilots and getting them better at what they do. Was there any of that that resonated with you or you think might resonate with Alaska Airlines?
Mr. Chair, Representative Betts, I want to check the source. Probably military is the main source of our pilots, but I want to find that out. Again, I just heard it today, and I would be happy to look into it. This article that I'm going to send you talks about we lead the nation, Alaska does, in navigation systems because of Alaska. And it, the story, half the story is about nobody in their right mind would try to land in Juneau, Alaska in the heavy fog and overcast without the kind of satellite system that we have. And we have the best record anywhere. But I'll try to find out pilot training-wise whether that's an argument that we would...
And maybe if I could amend on to that question, not only the sort of retrospective look at where your current pilots come from, but the forward-looking, given the changes in the makeup of the military, that would be interesting too. Thanks. Follow and then whatever.
Thank you. I had a most interesting meeting with the one of the generals up in Portland with the Air Force. And the discussion had to do with the expansion of the flight area over my district for training purposes.
For training, okay.
Right. And the explanation was that because of the ever-increasing cost of fuel, when the weather was bad, they couldn't fly over the ocean. They instead would fly back inland and thus wanted to expand the area testing over my district. And we talked about that at some length. But to follow up on Chair Reed's remark, the point is that they're training less because of the higher cost of fuel. Mm-hmm. And so one would wonder if there isn't some merit to the assertion that these smaller opportunities are important.
Representative Gorsuch.
Okay.
My computer is down right now, and so can somebody tell me again, because I don't have any paperwork here, what is the amount of tax increase we're talking about?
The proposal, according to the amendment...
the dash one.
That's right.
Yeah.
Goes from 1 cent to 3 cents. Have I got that correct?
Okay. And that's for both groups?
It's from...
It's a 2 cent increase in both cases. In the case of Avgas, it's from 9 to 11. In the case of jet fuel, it's from 1 to 3 if the dash 1 amendments were adopted.
Okay. And that would go for airports all across the state?
I don't think it's based on the airport. It's based on the purchase of the fuel wherever it occurs.
No, I mean the assistance that it's designed to do. Is that correct?
Okay. I understand that there's a process, grant applications, that sort of thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. PDX isn't the only airport that serves heavy jets, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, no. Eugene, Medford, Redmond, Klamath Falls, the first four are served by us. We don't serve in Klamath Falls or Coos Bay, but there are jets going in and out of there. The vast majority of jet fuel is used at PDX. It's refined on Puget Sound. Mm-hmm. It is shipped by pipeline. Now, because the pipeline is more crowded, some of it is barged out into the Pacific and back up the Columbia River. And it is distributed through various gasoline distributors or petroleum distributors in the metropolitan area of Portland. I believe that BP may be the current supplier of PDX, but I don't know that for certain.
And are any, yes, please, thank you. Are there any other airlines like United, well, United slash Continental anymore, but other airlines that serve other airports in the state that you don't serve?
Yes, and I wished I could tell you the smaller of the connecting airlines, but it used to be Delta Connection, it's something else. That
United serves. Express, I think, is out there still.
United Express.
Yeah, so it seems to me that while we focused on a very fine airline. I see them all the time, and the guy's face staring at me all the time. But it seems to me we focused on Alaska, but that national carriers are using a lot of our smaller airports. And so it seems to me that, don't you think that they should bear part of the cost of supporting those other fields?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gorsuch, they are right now. They pay the jet fuel tax.
Well, I mean, the proposed increases.
Well, the vast majority of the flights and the fueling is all done at PDX. Yeah. I can't speak to how much fueling is done at Redmond or at Medford or at Eugene.
But it is a system benefit.
I think that's a rhetorical point, perhaps.
Yeah, but that's my point. It's a system-wide thing, and State of Oregon needs the assistance.
Understood.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Gorsuch. Other questions? I don't see any. We've got two more people to testify on this bill. Ann Hannes, Craig Honeyman, please.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Ann Hannes. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. We do support this bill because we believe it will provide much-needed revenue for funding state and municipal airports. I think Representative Gorsuch made an excellent point, and that is we need to look at our aviation system, our system of airports, as a system, just as we view our road system, be it federal, state, county, city, is important for people to get from here to there and to conduct their business. Because if we didn't have a lot of those 100 public use airports around the state, they wouldn't be able to be important for not only commercial passenger traffic, but cargo, emergency access, search and rescue, firefighting, agricultural operations, military operations, among others. Of those 100 public use airports, 11 of them are owned by counties. And I think that all citizens around the state benefit in one way or another from having this a strong system of airports. And with budgets being stretched thin, not only on the state, but also on the local and now on the federal level that's coming down and affecting strongly all these different municipal airports, we do need to make sure that those airports remain safe, that maintenance and operations money is provided in order to have those airports be accessible and to keep them available for commercial and private and public use. So we would support providing additional revenues and to avoid airport closures, to enhance commercial activity, support economic development, and ensure access for firefighting and other emergency services. Thank you.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Craig Honeyman, Legislative Director of the League of Oregon Cities. Mr. Chair, thank you for taking my testimony. I did not get signed up. I didn't get into the room in time, so I appreciate that. The League represents all 242 cities, as I said. 33 of them own airports. Six of those offer passenger service, and 17 offer cargo service. I'm here today to express the League's support for House Bill 2766, as it appears before you today, and the aviation gasoline increase from 9 cents to 11 cents that is contained within it. I am not prepared, however, to tell you what the League's position is going to be is on the jet fuel, which I assume is the Dash 1 amendments you're referring to, the 1 cent to 3 cent per gallon increase. Due to the uncertainty that I have about the impact that that would have on smaller commercial airports that, as Mr. Martin indicated, have airline services that sometimes can come and sometimes they go. So I want to better understand what the impact of that increase would have on those smaller commercial airports. But back to the original bill, we totally support the revenues that this will garner cities as they attempt to deal with the newly increased federal match from 5 to 10% as a result of the 2012 Federal Aviation Administration reauthorization bill, the financial aid to municipalities program, which is an excellent grant program for these smaller airports, and finally the aviation search and rescue program. So I'm here, as I said, to support House Bill 2766 and reserve judgment on the Dash 1s. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Honeyman. Are there questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
You.
That completes the list of people who have signed up to testify on House Bill 2766. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard? See anyone. So I appreciate the testimony and the good discussion. It seems clear to me that we have a little bit more work to do amongst the committee, and I hope we will be returning to the bill before too long. But for now, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2766 and open public hearings on House Bill 2972 and 2973. Representative Doherty, do you want to get settled? And Troy can give us a summary, please.
Thank you.
Actually, just before you start, I think you could combine the two summaries just into one would be most helpful.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2972 repeals portion of Oregon Jobs Transportation Act of 2009 requiring Department of Transportation to contract out all maintenance activities on certain highway. State highway segment specifies repeal does not apply to contracts currently in effect, but does apply to new contracts and renewal of extensions of existing contracts. Declares emergency and effective upon passage. Very quickly, House Bill 2973 repeals portion of Oregon Jobs and Transportation Act of 2009 requiring Department of Transportation to contract all maintenance activities on state highway segments, requires Department of Transportation to terminate all existing contracts immediately or as soon as feasible, declares department perform all obligations and duties due under contract upon termination, declares emergency effective upon passage.
Thank you, Troy. Representative Doherty.
Thank you very much, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Margaret Doherty, and I represent House District 35, which includes Tigard and Southwest Portland. I'm here today to speak in support of House Bill 2973 and House Bill 2972, a bill that highlights efficient use of state dollars. This is not the first time I've been to this committee about this bill. I was here after the project had completed its first year, and after we found out how expensive the project was, I came
to this committee, but decided that it would be another year to the project to see what was happening. Everyone in this building talks about government efficiency and saving taxpayer dollars and prioritizing services to ensure that critical programs are preserved. What you have before you with these two bills does just that. A little bit of background, as a part of the 2009 Jobs and Transportation Act, the legislature decided to conduct a pilot project, and it created a program that privatized the maintenance of part of the highway system. What was chosen was a 26-mile stretch of road on Highway 219 between Shoals and Newburgh going up over Chehalem Mountain. And what was this 26-mile stretch of highway was contracted out to a private company. And the project was to last 6 years, but we found out after the first year and a half of the project that the costs are actually double from what ODOT can do the project for. What the project included was to have a private company, and I want to make very, very clear, ODOT is very pleased with what the private company has been doing. And some of the jobs that they're supposed to be doing is snow and ice removal, pavement maintenance, guardrail repair, sweeping, brushing, culvert cleaning, sign maintenance, all of that kind of thing. And that's what they were to do. We fast forward 4 years from 2009, and the result of this mandate is an overly expensive program that saves the state $0. In fact, it is in the first year and a half of the project, it is projected to cost more than twice as much as what it would have cost if the Oregon Department of Transportation was to maintain the highway. The expected cost for the contractor for those that year was $598,000. Compare that with a projected cost of $246,000 for ODOT to provide the same maintenance. The total cost of the experiment so far has now exceeded $1.5 million. And so that is one of the reasons that we're here. ODOT, and we also have people from ODOT to answer more of the technical questions. But not only with the idea of the money is that ODOT has also had to provide extensive training and to the contractor and leased a lot of equipment loaned equipment to the contractor at virtually no cost. There was one of the things that we're talking about is that ODOT took the following cost containment measures, thereby reducing the impact of the overall cost for the contractor. And part of these were, and this is in the last year, $18,700 from the period of December 2010 through January 31st, 2013, provided the contractor with materials from their nearby maintenance station in Newburgh, such as sander and de-icer. And the costs were not included in the total overall cost of the project, but were absorbed by the maintenance station. $25,500 were used to purchase and provide state radios for the contractor use at no charge. $17,800 to purchase and provide variable message signs for the contractor to use at no charge. And there are three or four other things that they did. So the idea was that the experiment was a noble thought, but the experiment has not worked. And what we're asking to do is have the experiment stopped because the contract that is with the contractor is for another 3 years. And if we're doubling the cost of what the highway maintenance is for this stretch of highway in Washington, Yamhill County, I don't think the state really wants to go through and spend another three times as much for this. As I said, ODOT is pleased with the progress made by the contractor in training and so on and so forth, but overall the contractor cost has been higher than ODOT's while the quality is comparable. We perform a lot of experiments in this building, and sometimes when the rubber meets the road, the results are less than what we had planned. If the current trend continues, the cost of this experiment may grow to be astronomical. We do not have the resources for a multi-million-dollar experiment, especially one that has so clearly ended up being what was not what we bargained for. So I urge support of House Bill 2972 and 2973.
Thank you, Representative Doherty. Let's see if there are any questions for you before we invite you back up here and ask the folks from ODOT any questions. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Doherty. If you don't have this detail, I'll be happy to repeat the question for ODOT staff.
Okay.
I actually have two questions. One is on the subject of loaning equipment to the contractor. Do you know whether the equipment, is this equipment that's expected to last for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, or does it deteriorate pretty rapidly under the conditions that it's used under? In other words, did the state lose value, and how do we account
like
for that?
Depreciation? Mm-hmm. I can't answer the specific question. I know that the equipment came from, for example, other parts of the state or the Newburgh maintenance station, but ODOT will be able to answer that question.
Okay, thank you. And the other one is when you mention another 3 years under this contract, I suppose someone has figured out what the net potential savings would be to discontinue the contract, because we know, we think we would know what it would cost for ODOT to do it. We think we know what it would cost for a contractor to do it, except for some of the costs. I remember hearing this a year or two ago. Some of those costs were one-time, like training or other sunk costs. So not everything that happened in the first year would happen in those last three.
Well, actually, this project has gone on for a year and a half, and so it was half of a fiscal year and half of another fiscal year. And the average per year cost included between the two for the ODOT would have been $97,000 for indirect costs and $149,000 for direct costs for a total of $246,000. For the first two calendar years with the contractor, it was $248,000 of indirect costs, $350,000 of direct costs for a total of $598,000.
Okay, thank you.
So that's actual money.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Parrish.
Thanks. Rep. Doherty, do you know what the contract between ODOT and the contractor, the language around ending the contract, buying the contract out, is there a cost to do that, or
no,
what does that
no,
look like?
No, there's an opt-out clause. There's no cost to the state for ending the contract.
Do you know where we can find terms of that?
Pardon?
Do you know where we can find terms of
I'm
that?
I'm sure
contract?
That Mr. Mather from ODOT will be able to tell you
great,
that.
Thanks.
But that was one of the things that we looked at last year, was whether they could get out. And since it was created by legislative authority, it can be ended by legislative authority.
Other questions?
Okay.
I don't see
the project.
Thank you, Representative.
Any other questions?
Please come on back.
Thank you.
Paul Mather and Mike Scott, please. And someone else.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. I brought Vivian Payne, our Regional Maintenance Manager, up with me to help answer some of your questions. I'm sure I can answer some of them, but I'm guessing there's going to be some more detail that Vivian will be able to fill in for you. So I'm here, obviously, to testify on 2972 and 2973, which repeal the requirements of ODOT to contract out maintenance on a segment of highway, which was part of the Jobs and Transportation Act of 09. That particular bill required a six-year pilot on a 10 to 30-mile segment. We went through a process and selected the Woodburn 219 highway, a 26-mile segment from Woodburn through Newburgh on Highway 219, and as you've heard, we just have begun our third year of work with the contractor on that. The contractor we selected was Eagle Elsner. He's a local contractor, and as you heard, he has done successful, acceptable level of work to date. The costs that were Representative Doherty talked about are reflected also in the report that should be a link to my testimony. Approximately $600,000 per year for the contractor's cost versus approximately $250,000 for our costs. So looking into, so why is the difference in those cost numbers between the two? And looking into those, I see really three different factors that I would point to. First is we've got different business models, obviously a public business model and a private business model as we look. Also, a significant fact is the overhead rates. The overhead rate for the contractor is spread over that 26-mile section. The overhead rates for ODOT is spread over our 8,000-mile state highway system. And probably the most significant one is the rage weights that are required. The BOLI rage weights range at the high end of $63 per hour, where our loaded rage weights are $36 per hour. As we put together the contract for this work, we...
Mr. Mather, may I interrupt just for a moment? Representative Benz has a question.
Mr. Mather, thank you for this. I think you say in your report that the $63 per hour rate is prevailing wages. That's a prevailing rate, which is imposed upon the contractor, and he must pay it. And do we have a number that if he wasn't required to pay prevailing wage, what that would be?
Chair Reed, Representative Benz, we do not. The requirement, as we started this process from Boley, required those wages, so we did not go through a competitive process to see what the wages would be through a competitive process.
Please. To understand exactly what the options are for these kinds of services, it would be interesting to know what they could be contracted for if there weren't those types of impositions in place. Do you know how we might obtain that number?
Chair Reed, Representative Betts, we've gone through a number of studies over the years comparing contracting out to ODOT work. We do a fair amount of contracting out of maintenance work on an activity-by-activity basis. Does not require Boley wages to be paid, so we get a competitive rate in those cases. It's when we put it together an entire project, in this case as we did, that we required those wages to be paid. So we could go look at some of those past studies or some of our active contracting work that we have throughout the state.
And follow up.
Go ahead.
And the state isn't required to pay prevailing wages, apparently, or our cost would be considerably higher. Is that a correct statement?
Chair Reed, Representative Benz, our costs are determined through the collective bargaining process that we go through.
Right. Right. So the answer is?
We're not required to have the Boley wages.
Thank you.
Go ahead, please.
Just one last piece I was going to talk about is, as we put this project together, we wanted to get to a performance-based contract where the contractor was paid based on the performance. Since we were new to this contracting, since the contractor was new, we've gone to a time and material contracting to gain some experience and reduce the risks. Because when we looked at those costs at the outset, both of us, the contractor and ODOT, were leery of the risk side, so the costs were very, very high. So as we go forward with this, ultimately during the six-year pilot, we would hope to get to a place where we could do some performance-based contracting and see what that cost would bear. So with that, again, I'm here to answer questions. I got Vivian Payne here also to help answer questions.
Let's hear from Mr. Scott first, and then we'll take questions. Please.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Mike Scott. I've been a highway maintenance worker with the Oregon Department of Transportation for the past 18 years. I'm the president of our local 730, which is a sublocal of SCIU. And as a union member, I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2973 and House Bill 2972. The 2009 Jobs and Transportation Act required ODOT to undertake a six-year pilot project to contract out maintenance of a 10 to 30-mile section of highway. ODOT submitted a report to the legislature this month summarizing the project to date. And bear with me if I'm redundant from Representative Doherty's testimony earlier. Some of this might be a little bit of the same number. So
you should feel free to summarize if you want
Okay, thank you. 2 years on the pilot project, one thing is clear. Contracting out highway maintenance is not cost-effective and is not efficient use of our taxpayers' dollars. To date, the pilot project has cost over $1.5 million dollars, and ODOT's historic average to maintain the same section of highway was about $246,000 per year. This pilot project costing ODOT three times more than doing the work in-house. These are the figures of how we have come to it through the procurement costs and the contract administration and the other overriding costs, which comes out to a total of $1,500,000. So that's where we're getting three times as much, and I don't want to contradict Representative Doherty, but those are how we're looking at these figures. If this bill is not passed, this pilot project will cost ODOT another $3 million over the course of the pilot. This may not sound like a lot of money to put in perspective. The average cost to maintain a one lane mile costs ODOT $3,330 to do. $3 million can pay for the maintenance of 900 lane miles. Aside from the actual dollar amount, this is about the principle. Do we want to be a state that wastefully spends taxpayer dollars when there is a less expensive alternative? In addition to the $1.5 million this project has cost ODOT, the agency provided the contract with additional resources. These include sand and de-icer. This cost $18,700. ODOT purchased and provided state radios for the contractor at $25,500. ODOT purchased and provided message signs that cost $17,800. And ODOT leased two plows to the contractor at a rate of $2,000 per month. And ODOT purchased a new 1,500-gallon slip-in de-icer unit at the cost of $50,000. ODOT employees continue to be responsible for incident response under this contract, paying all highway lighting and signal electric bills, permitting activities, providing environmental assistance, and providing traffic engineering support, providing state and federally required bridge inspections, and performing traffic signal inspections. The question I'd like to pose is, why are we paying a contractor three times more to complete work that can be done in-house by highly trained maintenance crews already employed by ODOT? In addition, why are we then dedicating additional staff time and resources to help the contractor do the job that they've been hired to do? The point of the pilot was to determine whether a contractor can do this work for less expensive amount. The answer is clear, no. Do we want to wait four more years to come to this conclusion? Just want to thank you for your time to talk about this subject.
Thank you, Mr. Scott. And Ms. Payton, did you have anything you want to add, or you're just here for our technical questions?
I'm here, Chair Reed, committee members. I am here for your technical questions, but I wanted to clarify.
I need to ask you to identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry, Vivian Payne. I'm the Region 2 Maintenance and Operations Manager.
Thank you.
And so one clarification, I think, from the report that both Representative Doherty and Mike referred to is, and that I believe it was one of the committee members' questions was on the equipment, and was that Representative Nathanson. And that was, we have two plow trucks, sander, one has a sander, one has a de-icer unit. ODOT spent about $50,000 refurbishing equipment that we already had. It would have been redeployed to another crew, so we did not purchase new, but we did refurbish that equipment. In that refurbishment cost was the cost to purchase a new slip-in de-icer tank and unit, so that was all inclusive. That is leased back to the contractor, so the contractor is paying for that, and we are recouping our costs on a monthly basis. So I just wanted to clarify that and make sure people understood that.
Got it. Representative Cameron and then Representative Parrish.
Oh.
I cut you off earlier.
Yeah. No, that's okay. I'm curious, when this experiment or test was set up, was ODOT consulted on the ideal mileage of roads that would be cost effective? We're talking about big pieces of equipment here. And I can't imagine, I think it says 10 to 30 miles. I can't imagine that it would be cost effective for anybody just to set up shop to do that. Can you talk a little bit about the consultation of what's the ideal miles?
Chair Reed, Representative Cameron, to my knowledge, we weren't consulted on that, but I will give you just some history and perspective. We've done a number of studies for the legislature over the years comparing contracted out maintenance work. The majority of that has been on activity-by-activity basis. This is the first time we've done it on a holistic basis. So I think the thought was to take a significant section of highway. The thought was a 10 to 30-mile section was a significant step in that direction without going too far and having a larger section that could have other consequences in the performance of maintenance work on the roadway. So while the overhead rate doesn't get spread out, you wanted to take a small step to get some feel for just how this was going to work in the contracting out. I think so it was trying to find a balance between those two.
Follow up with me. And then why is the vendor being required to pay almost twice as much per hour as ODOT pays?
Chair Reed, Representative Cam, that's a ruling we've got from Boley.
We have a copy of that ruling, and when was that ruling made?
Chair Reed, Representative Cameron, I can get you a copy of that. That ruling was made before we started the procurement process.
We can follow up on that. I certainly don't have it, but I imagine we can get it.
We can get that for you.
Representative Parrish, and then Representative.
So, I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name when you announced your name.
Mike Scott.
Mike, okay, thank you. So, when you testified, and forgive me because I'm not a transportation expert, new to the committee, but I'm going to kind of compare this to something that, from my world that I know, health inspections in food processing plants. So, if I were to hire my own inspector in a food processing plant, insource that and privatize that, USDA would still be responsible then to come in and do my inspections. So when you listed out things like inspections and environmental impacts and all of these things that the contractor wasn't doing, wouldn't that be done as a different part of the budget? I would not be expected to then hire USDA to come inspect my plant and pay them additional. But what I'm hearing you say is that should be a cost borne by the contractor. But I don't know where that works anywhere else in government that I'm familiar with.
In this situation here, with these activities, these go along with our regular maintenance activities. We work hand in hand with these aspects. They're more the engineering side. So, I am not sure if these were the costs that were incurred over the top of that or not. I believe that they are. These are over and above, like with the addition of the $1.5 million, the list of the de-icer and the sand, and that these also are extra costs that are incurred too.
Follow up.
Over above.
So I guess that still didn't quite answer the question, because in your testimony it was about inspections and environmental impacts, and those are none of the things that I would expect that they get to self-inspect and then turn back and notice to the ODOT and say, hey, we did a good job, without somebody from ODOT actually coming to do those inspections to qualify that, even if they hired their own inspectors on site, like, say, food processing plants do. So I get a private grader, but then USDA still comes back in behind and does the final inspection. I can't imagine that cost is borne by the contractor, but what you kind of read was that those things were part of the extra cost of this program. And believe me, I'm the most frugal person probably sitting up here, so I like a deal as much as anybody else. But I'm just kind of uncertain what the methodology used to compare apples to apples when that wouldn't make any sense to me, that they'd have to pay for their own inspectors.
I'll jump in for one sense. I mean, I think that's sort of the question we're confronting here, is if the service is provided by another, by an outside entity, in order to guarantee the outcome, we do have to account for those inspections and guarantees and so on. And so does the total cost, comparing those two things, come out the same, or which one is higher? So I think I get your point, but I also sort of get the point of the total cost is what matters here. So, Mr. Scott, if you want to comment on that, that'd be fine. But
Chair Reed, Representative Parrish, we can get that information for you to make sure you understand completely, because I'm not totally 100% sure, but this is what we're figuring is also part of it. But we can find out for sure on that.
Okay, can I just a different line of question for the ODOT folks? So for the ODOT, have you had conversations with the contractor? Were they aware of this hearing? Were they invited to this hearing by ODOT? Do they know that there's a possible cancellation of a contract happening?
Chair Reed, Representative Parrish, yes, they're here today.
But at whose request? Did you guys notify them?
We told them on Friday of the hearing, and it's of their choice they're here.
All right,
we have
you.
Two more people who have signed up to testify.
Okay, we'll great. Get to thank them. You.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. For the department, I appreciate the clarification on the equipment. So I'd like to follow up just a little bit on radios having been purchased, variable message signs, and so forth. Now, this is something that the department had been maintaining, that section of highway already. So I'm trying to understand, the department would have already owned radios and signs and so forth, so we purchased additional materials or supplies to provide the contractor. Was the contractor then billed
for those as well?
Chair Reed, Representative Nathanson, the issue we were confronted with early on is overhead rate and trying to keep the overhead costs down or at least as comparable as we could between the work that we do and the work that a contractor does. So there is a lot of equipment, a lot of materials that we buy in big bulk and big quantities that specialize for maintenance that we wanted to provide to the contractor to keep as close as we could as level playing field. So some of that specialized snow plowing equipment, the de-icer stuff, the radios that we have that are unique to ODOT, those are things that we provided. Once the contract's over, they're still property of ODOT. We'll use them elsewhere in our maintenance work.
You look like you're contemplating a follow-up.
No, that's okay. Okay. I have opinions, but I don't need to follow up with questions.
All right, very good.
That's okay.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Can you talk about what's involved in road maintenance? Because I think of just simply, I don't know, restriping and putting some more asphalt down, but is it more involved than that? Anybody can answer.
I think you get to decide what you're asking.
Yeah. I'd like to hear both from the administration side and the worker side.
Very good.
There's a whole number of activities that go into basic highway maintenance, from striping to putting new asphalt down, grind inlay, pothole patching, we have blade patching, and that's all different aspects of paving. You have deep base paving. You also have shoulder rebuilding, and we keep our shoulders together. We have vegetation management, which is herbicide application, keeping our right-of-way clear. We have brushing. We have tree falling. We have incident response. We respond to accidents, all sorts of accidents. And ODOT's also, we are experts on traffic control. We're the best. And we do all sorts of elaborate types of traffic control, and we have all the equipment to do it. So we do winter maintenance is the thing we do. Also, we do best that we're experts at keeping the highway open, snow blowers, snow plows, chain detail. We have people that do that. Things as simple as site posts, fixing guardrail, keeping the guardrail up, barrier work in the median. I can just go on and on with the activities that we have, culvert cleaning.
And thank you. And I'll make a point. Okay. Follow up. I think most of us look at this and think, we're going to run a pilot project to do some paving and see if we can do that a little more efficiently. What we've asked a contractor to do is incident response, essentially be what we used to have police do, rebuild sections of road and shoulders, and do a whole litany of things that require an incredible capital cost. And I think, you know, it's worthy of discussion whether or not this was set up in a manner that was appropriate, frankly.
Thank you. So you all do this for the highway structure, and this is going to sound naive, but who does it for my city? I mean, do they contract that out? Or because my city, I can't imagine, maintains everything they need to do all this. So are they contracting out? Are they contracting with you? Or just in general, cities in general, who are they contracting out to do this? And do we have any information on comparably what it's costing out there for the roads that you're not maintaining that others are maintaining? So we actually have some apples to apples comparison of how that's working compared to this pilot, compared to what you all are providing for the highway portion.
Representative Parrish, each road authority is responsible for maintaining their own system. So your city or county would be maintaining their system. They typically have crews similar to what we have, crews that perform that work, but it's different jurisdiction by jurisdiction how much they rely on contracts to do different parts of work or the nature of different types of work. I'm not aware off the top of my head of any city or county that contracts out 100% of their road maintenance work. There's certainly a lot of activity that we contract out, and there's a lot of activities that I'm sure cities and counties contract out.
Follow up?
Yes.
But they are contracting out, and they must be finding some level of efficiency in doing that. Otherwise, you know, City of West Linn would maintain a full infrastructure, and Tualatin would maintain full infrastructure. But I don't see that happening. I don't see when I'm driving around that all of my local work is being done, and that's not being contracted out successfully. So I'm
Chair Reed, kind of curious. We do a fair amount of contracting out. If ODOT does activity by activity. Again, we're making that business decision of whether we invest in a specialized piece of equipment or the scale of the work that's out there. We do contract out work just as other jurisdictions make that same decision based on their scale of work and the type of work and the special nature of the type of work they may be having to do.
One more. Just
go ahead.
So this project, based on, is a 26-mile segment. How was that figure how did you come to that figure, given that there are 8,000 miles of road and 26 miles is this really small bite of the apple? How do you get to the economy of scale in a project like this on 26 miles? And to Representative Davis's point, the huge cost of capital, I'd be curious if you have documentation of how this pilot program, the methodology for developing it, because 26 miles doesn't seem like I'm going to get any kind of economy of scale out of that.
The Chair Reed, Representative Parrish, the bill specified between 10 and 30 miles, and so we picked a section that was 26 miles.
Okay.
And again, what's different about this, it's everything of road maintenance. Typically, when we contract out, it's contract out for ditching, it's contract out for guardrail repair. It's a segment of what we do. This is different than other contracting out in that essentially everything that our typical road maintenance crews do, we contract it out under one contract.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Doherty?
If I can make some clarification, I think the one thing that ODOT did with this experiment is it wasn't just a section of road. And go back, I know the city of Tigard has a huge public works, and you know the city employees are the ones that deal with all of our city roads. But if you've been over that stretch of highway between Shoals, up over Shayla Mountain, down into Newburgh and then into Woodburn, it's got everything from the top of a mountain that would have ice and snow on it to partly freeway to through a city to a very rural area with a very small town. So I thought that they picked, I was not involved in this at all when it first began, they picked a real varied stretch of highway. So it wasn't just a straight highway going down. It was everything that could have ice and could have curves and could have city and could have rural. So I thought they did a pretty good job of getting a stretch of highway that was almost contained everything, to get some sort of a feel of it.
Thank you. Representative Davis?
In other words, a section of highway was chosen that would be the most expensive to maintain.
No, because
it has all those costs.
Representative Davis, I think you look at that stretch of highway, is also a stretch of highway that doesn't have huge traffic implications. In other words, big trucks don't go over it, which is, chops up roads and that kind of thing. So, I mean, if you drive over Chehalem Mountain, it's kind of a shortcut between Shoals and Newburgh, but it's not a major thoroughfare.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you. You mentioned you contract out for ditching and rail repair. Is prevailing wage required of those vendors when they're doing that particular work?
Chair Reed, Representative Cameron, in our experience in contracting out activity by activity, it is not required. It's when you lump it together, this holistic contracting that we're talking about, is when the ruling came that it was required to pay the prevailing wage. So on activity by activity, we have to pay in all of the wages.
So in this particular situation, if you were to contract out to repair a piece of railing on this particular stretch, you wouldn't be paying the loaded $63. You'd be paying what?
Chair Reed, Representative Cameron, I'd have to look up what a typical contract out number would be, but it would be less than that number.
So around the $36 that you pay, somewhere in there. And follow up, if I may.
Yep. Yeah, I'd want to look at the numbers before I guess.
So, but this contractor, when they're repairing that same piece of railing, is being required to pay $60-whatever dollars an hour.
Right.
We set these guys up for failure from the beginning. Thank you.
Are you pointing or are you seeking recognition?
I'm seeking.
Representative Gorsuch.
I'm seeking.
No problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question. What was the... Because I don't quite understand this. What was the trigger that caused you to need the decision from Boley? Was it just this? Is there a line on a graph somewhere where you get to a certain level and then you go over and...
Well, Chair Reed, Representative Gorsuch, it's part of our procurement process that we asked that question on our contracts. Again, I wasn't part of what... the group that put this particular contract together. Right. I could pull that together for you as along with the ruling from Boley, what prompted us to ask Boley that question.
I would be curious of that.
But yeah. I believe it's a typical part of our contracting process that we ask that question.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you all three very much.
Thank you.
We have two more people.
Thank you.
Mr. Scott, did you have another?
I really do, Chairman Reed. If I can just say one more thing, that the difference between construction and maintenance is apples and oranges. And I wanted to make sure that when we at ODOT, we're maintenance. We have very small maintenance crews, and when we contract out construction jobs. And ODOT oversees those construct. We're talking multi-million dollar projects. The thing about it is that we maintain them afterwards when it's all done. We maintain it. And we maintain a very small level. We have the expertise to go and do small projects that are pretty big, that take some time. But for the most of it, we have our maintenance schedule and that we do. So there is a big difference. I just want to make sure that was clear to the conversation here. And the one more thing, President Cameron, I was on the initial committee when we sat down to go over the criteria for the 219 project when it was first initiated back in 2009. And it was myself and another union member and four district managers plus the Office of Maintenance. And we sat down for about a three-hour meeting really wringing our hands on how we were going to do this, because the one thing, we were not going to set them up to fail. We were going to make sure that was in our hands at that table what we talked about. We could have picked out some major snow zone and gave it to them, but we knew we weren't going to do that. We bent over backwards at that meeting and through this period of time to really help for this thing to be successful and give them every chance that they could. That's one thing I just want to make clear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Go ahead. Thank you. Mike, I appreciate that. My point being, and I think I just heard in your testimony, that maintenance and building roads is two different things. When we build roads, we have a prevailing wage rate in this state. When we maintain roads, we don't. And I think that's the point. We're making these guys pay a prevailing wage for maintenance. They're not doing construction. That's my point. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't want to get too much into back and forth, but I
believe there's a dollar amount of a statute when prevailing wage has to come in, sir. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you. Neil White and Jake McMichael have signed up to testify. Anyone here? I don't see anyone. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on either of these bills? Thank you. If you could please begin with your name for our records.
My name is Jake Eagle, and I'm an employee of Eagle Elsner.
Okay.
And I didn't think I signed up for testimony, but I can answer any of your questions if you have any.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. Sir?
I'm Dick Eagle. I'm half owner of Eagle Elsner. We're the dirty rats that are costing you all the money.
And did you want to make any comments, or are you also just here to answer questions?
Well, the question about Boley wages came up when we were first looking at this, and it seemed to me that in order to be a reasonable cost comparison, we should be able to have employees who are on salary much the same as maintenance people. But the economy of scale doesn't really work when you have an office at McMinnville that has 440 lane miles and 12 employees. That comes out to about 38 miles per employee. We have 26 miles total, and we can't do anything with two-thirds of one guy. And there's no place to put traffic if you have an incident. There's no shoulders. You have to flag it. And we have incidents all the time. We have incidents at night, over the weekends, anytime there's a snowstorm or a rainstorm or a windstorm, we have to report to any incidents that come up. And you can't do it with one guy. You have to have enough people to flag traffic around a wreck or shut the road down in case there's a tree across it or whatever. So the economy of scale worked against us on this thing. I, I don't argue the fact that it costs more than it would have for the McMinnville yard to take care of this, because they have other miles that they can allocate their time to and drop in on 219 every now and then.
Thank you. Representative Parrish.
Thank you for coming. I appreciate you being here. Have you done just some numbers on how many miles it would take for this to pencil? I mean, because I appreciate that there are some different costs and that you're under a different labor cost, certainly, than the state is. Even with that different labor cost, I mean, is there at some point, although I disagree with the fact that they're not comparable, but is there some point where you say 100 miles makes this pencil, 1,500 miles makes this pencil? Where does this...
That's a lot of miles.
Because 26 miles, I mean, that's like me trying to, you know, sell a new line of cereal and I'm only going to package two boxes and put all that cost into it.
Comparable at about 75 miles, but I'm not sure it ever will be comparable if we pay Bowie wages.
Gotcha.
It also depends on the type of miles that you're putting on there. So this particular stretch of road from milepost 10 to 18 is towards the end of its life cycle. It needs some capital money put into it to put it back up to code. And once you do that, then your maintenance dollars drop significantly. So you don't need to maintain a brand new road.
Mr. Representative Davis.
Can you just, I know you guys didn't have prepared testimony, but I think the committee might be interested in just sort of hearing 2-3 minutes on what was it like coming into this contract, what were some of the challenges, how has it worked well, how has it not worked well? Because we've heard the state side, I'd just be interested in hearing your side.
Initially, there was an RFI, and I think about 20 contractors responded. And then they decided to go for an RFP for a price, and I think there was 5 or 6 actual bids that came in, and we were low. But it didn't make sense, even at our lowest bid, it didn't make sense for ODOT to give us that dollar amount to maintain this road, because it was so much higher than what they'd been spending. But the road at the time, before we took it over, was classified a C road, and they wanted to upgrade it to a B road. And by comparison, I-5 would be an A road, or 99W would be an A road. This is a secondary road, sort of. But in the past, it's been a C, and when we had bad snowstorms, they just closed it. In 07, they closed it. Couldn't get to it because they were too busy on 99 and I-5. And we've improved the level of service substantially, I think, in that aspect. I'd like to say one thing about the equipment, the trucks that we have. I think they have, one of them has 400,000 miles, the other one has 500,000. It's not like they're costing you a lot of money. They're maintained and they run, but they're not brand new equipment.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you. You mentioned you have to flag it when there's an accident. I've driven that road many times. My parents used to live at the top of the hill. And what do you pay the flagger?
Certified pay.
Which is what?
I'm thinking with payroll burdens around 45.
Probably
40 to 45.
That's sufficient.
Thank you.
Anything else you gentlemen would like to say? Oh, Representative Benz, sorry.
Thank you. First of all, I want to thank you guys for working with us in this exercise, which started out innocently enough. But if we had to do it again, and I hope at some point we need to spend a lot more time designing what it is we're trying to accomplish, and then working with people in your positions to get it, you know, in a way that it works for illustrative purposes. Because much of what you've told us is not in the report. I think Paul did a great job on the report, but it's like you're in different wavelengths entirely. And so what I would hope
Mr. Chair, is that we will work with these folks to design a project that will result in the outcomes that we were hoping 4 years ago when we suggested this in the JTA.
Or at least the answers to the questions, right?
Well, at least, if I may, if I think, we can sit down and say, well, this is what we wonder about, and then design our way backwards into a system that will work. And given where we are, these gentlemen would be hugely helpful in that
Indeed.
Exercise. So I won't ask them now for those kinds of things. I'll just say that it would be a shame after this type of investment to allow this this opportunity to look into this to be lost.
I appreciate that. I certainly agree with it. There are always at least multiple perspectives on any experience like this, so we can certainly learn from your comments as well. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So I'm assuming you do other types of projects that don't involve working with the state. Yes, no?
Yes, we do asphalt paving for the state, the counties, cities,
and in this scenario where this particular project requires you to pay this bully wage, what is the wage when you're not in that box?
About two-thirds.
Okay.
It'll vary a little bit depending on the skill of the person and the agreements you've hashed out with him.
So that actually would be less than the state wage. Not that I don't want people to make money, but that would actually be about $10 less than the state gave us as their fully loaded budget if it was two-thirds.
More than that. You said $63, didn't you?
$63 for you, $35 for them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Representative Davis.
Can you tell us, it sounded like we're about a year and a half into you actually doing work. Is that correct, A? And what sort of major capital costs have you incurred? Because now we're talking about canceling the contract, and you guys have, I think, tried to work in good faith with the state. And have you made big purchases that you were intending to amortize over a period of time? Or
that's probably why we ended up with the two trucks. A new truck, fully outfitted like it needs to be, with a sander or a slip-in de-icer tank, is about $250,000. Last year, one of those trucks that we had got a total of 300 miles on it for the whole year, and that included driving down to the yard and back. So I don't know how you amortize a $250,000 truck over 300 miles and make it work. And it's got a pencil. So that's why we ended up leasing from ODOT, and they thought it was probably, on this pilot project, a smart way to go. They leased us some trucks out of their fleet, older trucks, but they were in good shape work-wise. And we pay them a lease amount, and they pay us for the truck. And it's kind of a $0 deal. If I thought it was for sure going to be a six-year deal, I would have thought harder about buying more equipment, but I didn't buy hardly anything. For instance, if you have to mow the shoulders and you need a tractor with an arm on it and a mower hanging down in the ditch, you're going to spend $100,000. on the other hand, you can mow the whole job in a week. So we opted to rent somebody with an owner-operator to do it, just like the state does. It doesn't make sense to go buy a $100,000 tractor and mower for a week's worth of work twice a year. Spraying is another one. The de-icer can be used as a herbicide applicator, but you have to have a licensed herbicidist running it. And you can hire a company that has a satellite picture of the whole job, and it'll tell them what kind of spray they have to use in different areas because they're close to a water, a stream or a waterway where you have to use different material than you use in other places. It's a highly technical deal, and they can spray the whole job in 3 days. So I didn't go buy a sprayer.
Thank you. And I want to thank you, gentlemen, for coming and sharing and helping here. You just mentioned you hired a subcontractor to mow the stretch. Did you have to pay him prevailing wage?
Yes. And anybody we hired had to have, and we had a guardrail guy too that we had to pay. He had to pay prevailing wage. And we had to turn in certified payrolls.
Follow up. Maybe this is ODOT can get back to me. They're still here. Could they let me know when they hire that same contractor, do they pay prevailing wage?
They said no.
In the bully contracts, bully enforced contracts, if it's under $50,000, they don't have to pay bully wage rates. So if you have a contract that's over $50,000, then you do have to pay the prevailing wage. So this contract, anything you do under the contract, the total dollar amount applies, so it's over $50,000.
It's a total contract.
We are nearing the end of our time. I want to give everybody one last shot with their questions. I think most people have been able to ask. And thank you very much for being here. You've added some valuable perspective to our discussion today. I think it's clear we have some more discussion to have, some more work to do, and we appreciate the discussion today.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who needs to be heard on this bill before we close the public hearing? I don't see anyone. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bills 2972 and 2973. Committee, anything for the good of the order? We'll be back on Wednesday. Thank you very much. Committee's adjourned.
Did they count the thing tonight?
No, I got to deal at home.